93X presents the Celebration Rock Podcast with Steven Hayden.
This is the Celebration Rock Podcast presented by 93X FM in Minneapolis. I'm your host, Steven Hayden. So this is technically our second episode, though we're posting on the same day as the pilot. So it's basically a co-pilot to the main pilot. If you're wondering what exactly this podcast is about, I break it down in the introduction to the first episode. If you did listen to that one already, though, why don't we just get started? My guest on this episode is Chuck Klosterman, a man who wears many hats. You might know him as a culture writer, a sports journalist, a frequent talking head in documentaries, or as the best-selling author of Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs, Killing Yourself to Live, and I Wear the Black Hat. But the vocation I was most interested in talking about with Klosterman was his past life as arguably the most famous rock critic of the early 21st century, a reputation forged with his first book, Fargo Rock City, and his stint at Spin Magazine. Klosterman has since moved into a larger world beyond rock criticism, but he still loves rock and roll, and we talked a lot about the state of rock at the moment. Toward the end, I also got him to talk about his forthcoming book, including one rock-related chapter that he was somewhat reluctant to talk about in detail, but I was able to weasel out a little bit of details from him. Anyway, it was a really great conversation, and here it is. I wanted to begin with a question that I think I asked you over email once, but I'm curious to hear what you would say now. Do you still think of yourself as a rock critic? You know, because recently you've actually done a couple of musician profiles. You did the Taylor Swift thing for GQ and that Eddie Van Halen story. Was that for Hollywood Reporter?
No, or for Billboard? Eddie Van Halen was for Billboard and Taylor Swift was for GQ.
And I mean, for the most part, you haven't written about music a ton in recent years, but I feel like if I went to a concert and asked like 10 random people to name a rock critic, that you would be the person most named in that kind of scenario. But like for yourself, like, do you still identify in that way?
You know, not really, I guess. I feel like when I was probably at Spin, I did. And certainly that's a world I exist in, and many of my closest friends are rock critics. But, you know, I'm really kind of a generalist. Music is one thing I do. This is, like, of course, an incredibly arrogant thing to say, but I often think about it how, like, when I would see interviews with Led Zeppelin, and they would get asked if they were a metal band. And their argument would always be like, well, we do that sometimes, but we're not really a metal band. I kind of feel the same way. Like, that I do write about music, but I don't know if I'm really a rock critic. I definitely don't feel as if I'm in sort of the very insular world of rock criticism that sort of now exists and has always existed. That in many ways is to me more of the demarcation than the actual content of what you're producing. Like, there's just sort of a kind of an ingrained, always ground zero world of rock criticism. And it basically is conversation between other rock critics about rock criticism. And I don't really feel like I'm in that. Maybe I was briefly for a time, but definitely not now.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask, when you were writing, like, Fargo Rock City or something, was there like an ambition in your mind where, like, I want to be like Lester Bangs, or I want to be like other great rock critics from history, or was that never part of your thinking?
That was never part of it. You know, in fact, you know, when somebody compares you to another writer, another famous writer, it's a weird thing because you know consciously it's a compliment, right? The reason they're comparing you to somebody who is successful or has an established career or an established writing style, the reason they're making that comparison is an attempt to sort of compliment your work. So you have to take it as a compliment. But it never feels good. Like, I don't want to be like anyone else. you know, it's sort of like if you have a band and people say, like, your band is great, you sound just like the Beatles. Well, that's only good if you're a Beatles tribute band. you don't want to be like someone else, even if they're awesome. So I had zero aspirations to be like any other rock critic or even sort of to be viewed as part of that continuum. It wasn't as though I was against the idea. It just wasn't part of it at all, you know.
I mean, I think it's one thing.
And also, I have to admit that at the time I wrote Fraggle Rock City, I had not read a lot of the stuff that is sort of central to that conversation. I'm sure I have now. But at the time I wrote that book, I absolutely had not. Yeah.
Right. What I was going to say before, I mean, it's one thing for someone to say you sound like the Beatles. It's another thing to say you're this era's equivalent to the Beatles. And I feel like it was more maybe the latter for you, at least like in the 2000s when you were working for Spin and writing a lot of music books.
But that still means that you're sort of a simulation thematically of something that happened before. It's still not new. Like, you know, using this kind of metaphor or whatever, you know, if someone says, you know, we went to Japan and they treated us like the Beatles or whatever, that's still a non-unique experience then. They're saying that the experience we had is something that reminds me of something that happened before. And I think that, you know, the idea for anyone should be to do something that didn't exist before or to have an experience that didn't exist before. So, I mean, I know what you're saying is complimentary, and I definitely take it as a compliment. All the people you mentioned, if someone says, I put you in this class, of course that's a nice thing to hear, you know, but it's still weird. You know, that's not the goal.
You know, and this is going to seem like a very Chuck Klosterman type question, but, you know, are you self-aware enough to, like, look outside of yourself and see how you signify a certain kind of rock critic? I mean, like, I'm thinking about that episode of Documentary Now that you were in. And for people who haven't seen it, it's a show on IFC with Fred Armisen, Bill Hader, and Seth Meyers is involved with it. And they do documentary parodies. And the season finale was this two-part episode where it was it was about this fictional rock group called the Blue Jean Committee. And it was basically a parody of that Eagles documentary with that came out a couple years ago, along with some other things as well. But you were in that episode, and it was clear that you were meant to signify rock critics, but it was also a very specific reference to you. Like, in a way, it was almost like you were satirizing yourself by being in that episode. Like, what was your thought process, I guess, with that? And do you think about, you know, as someone who doesn't want to necessarily be just known as a rock critic, but also knowing that you kind of signify the, I don't want to say cliches, but like what people imagine a rock critic is?
Well, I mean, first of all, if you are a rock critic, there's nothing more fun than pretending to be a rock critic. I mean, that's the most fun thing possible. And, you know, there's just, the way I looked at, you know, they asked me to do it, and I was flattered they asked me. I thought it was surprising that they did. It's really fun to kind of do anything that's kind of improvisational where they give you, like, I, of course, this band doesn't exist, so it's not like I could study them. They just sort of said, like, well, the band would be sort of, I think they said, imagine if Air Supply got as big as the Eagles, you know, but their career was super short, like, I don't know, like Elastica or something. And I was like, oh, okay, well, let's imagine this fake thing, you know. And it's always, you know, sort of, you know, levels of fakeness in a way. I mean, there's the experience you have listening to music. That's as real as you can get, okay? And then you move up to the idea of sort of talking about that with someone else, where you're trying to sort of express that real experience in words. And then there's writing, which is a little more formal, okay? So you're writing when you're writing a review of a record, it's different than talking about it or just listening to it. Right. And then there's the further jump where it's like, hey, can you be in this documentary and sort of boil down what you wrote into conversation that seems as though you're speaking off the cuff when, of course, you're not. I mean, that's like when I was in that LCD Sound System documentary. That was a really weird thing, okay, because I had interviewed James Murphy for The Guardian, and that interview went great. And the piece, I thought, was okay. Like, I was pretty happy with it. Then, you know, a year and a half later or whatever, the directors contact me, and they say, we're making this movie now. We want you to interview James Murphy just like you did for The Guardian piece. So I thought, well, okay. that's cool or whatever. I'll interview him again. But then I realized they wanted me to interview him exactly like the Guardian piece. Like they sort of were hoping I would ask the exact same questions.
Right.
And it was very weird. So then now I'm in a movie playing myself, but I'm acting. And then when I only watched the movie once because it's really obviously uncomfortable to watch yourself on screen like that. But as I watched myself in this documentary, I did think I'm not doing a very good job of acting like myself. Like it didn't seem the way I am to me. Yeah.
Well, and I mean, you must have sensed on some level that they wanted you in the movie for a reason, and that there was a certain quality that they felt that you had to deliver. I mean, did you feel like, well, I have to be a version of myself that people, you know, project onto me in a way?
Well, I think the thing was is the interview that I did with Murphy for The Guardian, the actual one, went exceptionally well, and I think he liked the questions because they were probably different questions than what he usually got. I feel like there's a certain kind of artist who tends to get asked the same things over and over and over again. I feel like he was very much in that class. So we talked about different things and more in kind of in more an abstract way. And I could tell during the interview he liked it. So I thought to myself, like, well, that went well. When they asked me to be in the movie, I got the sense that they wanted like a simulacrum of that. Like they wanted it to happen again. So if you notice in that film, like they're shooting from behind me, you really only see my face a couple times. So I think it wasn't that I was supposed to bring anything specific to it. I think that I was supposed to kind of represent the media.
Right.
You know, I don't know if it's in the movie, but at one point they were like, can you write in your notebook? And we'll just, you know. So there's like I'm not sure if this made the film or not in the end, but I know there's footage of me writing in my notebook. When I'm writing is like, I am writing in my notebook. Like I'm literally, because I hadn't asked a question or anything, you know. I felt a little dumb doing it, to be honest, now that I'm talking about it. But at the same time, it's, you know, that movie will show up on Palladium or whatever in 20 years if Palladium still exists, and it will be a neat thing, kind of, you know. And it was cool to have someone say, "I want you to be involved with this thing," which as a concert film is exceptionally good. I mean, if I recall, they had a very small number of cameras that they used for that concert, and you would swear they had 380 cameras. I mean, they just. It's amazing what they did with it. So I was happy to be involved, but it is weird to be yourself in something when you're not really being yourself.
Right.
But then again, it's the same way for James Murphy in every interview he gives,
right,
where he sits down and talks to someone, and he's not really being himself. He's being the version of himself he uses in public to give interviews to promote his band.
Right. Yeah, it was interesting, the narrative that was imposed on that movie that Murphy clearly wanted people to take from that movie. Like I think it's really well made too, and I like it in a lot of ways, but I gotta say I was a little depressed the first time I saw it because, you know, the natural corollary to that movie is The Last Waltz. And mm-hmm. when you watch that movie, it's pretty clear that the band is at the end of their career. Like they've done everything that they're gonna do, and it is sort of like a wake in a way for their career. Whereas with LCD Sound System, there's just something about a band like that that instead of really going for it, they decided to pull the plug. You know, right when they seem to be hitting critical mass. There's something about that that seems very indicative of like bands that came out of that era, early 2000s. You know, The Strokes, The White Stripes to a degree. These bands that you would think, if they were in the 60s or 70s, maybe could have become like legacy bands that get passed down from generation to generation. They just decide not to do it.
They have a
and quit.
They have a higher awareness, though, of maybe what part of their value is. I mean, I think that traditionally, that a lot of artists, and not just in music, kind of in film, writing, and all things, that they sometimes failed to realize or consciously chose not to realize that a big part of what made their music sound good was the sense of sort of, for lack of a better term, coolness that came with it, that was solely a product of their smallness and exclusivity. And that a band like LCD Sound System, you know, playing at Madison Square Garden for their last show, that's kind of like the only show they can do that at, right? Like that was, they're not designed to play to an audience the size of Nickelback or whatever. And it's just a deal. And I think that James Murphy, probably more than most musicians, values that idea. I mean, in a weird way, it's kind of a strange thing to value, but I think that post 2000, the idea of being a cool band became more important and was prioritized over being a successful band, which would have been the case in the 70s. I mean, like a band like Grand Funk Railroad or whatever wanted to be cool, but they wanted to be popular more. And that sort of changed post 2000, partially because of the actual value of music, but because of Napster and because of file sharing and because all these things changed, the benefit to being popular decreased. There wasn't sort of the massive amount of wealth that could be accomplished from being a big artist. So the idea of being identified as a cool artist became more meaningful.
But I mean, and I think that's true, but you can still have a long career. I mean, there's a band like Wilco, for instance, which has certainly outlasted its sort of cool period, you know, which, you know, existed in the late 90s and early 2000s. I mean, they now, you know, more often than not get described as like a dad rock band. But at the same time, I think there's something valuable to having those kind of touchstone artists that are always around. I mean, like a band like U2, for instance. I mean, U2's cool period, you know, it's like 20 years in the past at this point, if not longer. But I think there is something worthwhile to having a band that just sort of everyone knows and is a gateway band in a way. And maybe that's the first band you've ever heard of if you're first starting to get into music, and then you started to get into the cool stuff. There's just something kind of defeatist, I think, about that attitude. Like, well, we're not cool anymore, so it's over. And I you're always going to have bands like that, but it doesn't seem like there's enough of the other kind of thing.
But
people
Wilco
don't care.
The example of Wilco is like their group that is pretty consciously aging with their audience.
Right.
I mean, you know, like the Uncle Tupelo records and the first couple of Wilco records, those were cool records. They were much more cool than they were popular.
Right.
You know, and then they moved into sort of that kind of sweet spot where they were a cool band who was successful, you know, that was kind of critically acclaimed and selling records and, you know, and could play anywhere and people would show up. And then they kind of move into this next phase where Jeff Tweedy is sort of freed from the idea of having to do any of these other things. So he's just kind of pursuing his own interests, and that music falls in line with what a 50-year-old guy is interested in, because the 50-year-old guy is still sort of working from the model of rock that he grew up with, and so is Jeff Tweedy. I mean, U2 is a different situation where they are, the goal was to be the biggest, most important band in the world. And the fact that they, in a way, in a certain context, achieved that has made at least Bono feel as though this is something that we have to protect and perpetuate and find new kind of novel ways to sort of make this happen. One of this, you know, was like, let's release our record to everyone with an iPhone, even if they didn't know it was supposed to exist. You know, we all get this record. Now, that ended up backfiring. They overlooked something weird that was impossible to know about people's phones, which is that people see their phones now as a literal extension of themselves. So the idea of a free record on your computer is one thing. Showing up on your phone like that, it seemed like an invasion of privacy. But I mean, that was an attempt to be like, well, if this works, this will kind of continue to put us in this class of cultural importance. Whereas Wilco is not interested in cultural importance at all. Like, I think if you interview Jeff Tweedy and wanted to talk about his cultural importance, even if he sort of felt the desire to sort of express something that would validate that this is important to him, he would never say it.
No.
Because that's outside sort of what that band is taken to mean and what he wants that band to mean.
You know, going back to the U2 thing, I wonder if, do you think the situation would have been different if the record they gave away was the Joshua Tree? Like if they had made the Joshua Tree in 2015 or like Octoon Baby, like a really undeniably great record, do you think people would have reacted differently, or was it merely the fact that people felt like their phones were invaded and it didn't matter how good the record was?
Well, that's a difficult question, because the idea of making Joshua Tree or making Octoon Baby, that's actually impossible. I mean, the record that they put out was almost like a collage of their entire career.
If they had made their Time Out of Mind, you know, like a late career, you know, record that people recognize as being good.
It still would have annoyed people. Because,
right.
I mean, even like Time Out of Mind, which was wildly loved record and critically acclaimed record, kind of like Love and Theft is, part of that had to do with the age of the person creating it and the fact that there was maybe a fear that this person's ability to sort of kind of dabble in greatness is done. And then, oh, here's something that's pretty good. So and it was only appealing to the people who thought about Bob Dylan. You know, I mean, it's like, okay, the Rolling Stones, for example, the Rolling Stones occasionally will put music out, you know, and if they put a record, like the record Black and Blue, which no one liked when it came out, if they made a record that good now, it would blow their mind, and people would say it's the best record anyone made in the last 10 years, and then they would talk about saving rock music and all of these things, because the sort of the parameters for value and the bar gets changed as people age. So, like, what could you two have done that would have made people enjoy that record? It would have had to have been something completely new that they had never done before, and sort of tapped into something that people didn't know they were going to like. But even that, I think, it would have been tough, because the reaction people had to this thing, which, you know, I mean, you can just delete it. So you can, there's no penalty. Like, it's not like it's eating up all your RAM and your phone's not going to work. Like, you can just delete it instantly, or you could just not listen to it. You could just not care. I mean, I don't know how many records I have on my iTunes that I haven't listened to in years. You know, they don't bother me. But this bothered people. One of the many things that's sort of interesting about this period of time we are in the culture is this sort of awareness of the meaning of privacy and the idea that privacy is something that needs to be protected even if it has no benefits. Like, you know, it's solely an abstraction.
Well, I think in U2's case, there was also an element, I think certainly in the media, that it wasn't appropriate for a band like that to do something like that. That it was ridiculous for U2 to think, you know, as a band, as a rock band, you know, with the members are in their mid-50s now, that they could ever be relevant in any context. So for them to put their album on people's phones like this just seemed like the peak of hubris, in a way where maybe I feel like people wouldn't have reacted as strongly if it was Rihanna doing that.
They wouldn't have reacted as strongly if Rihanna had did it, but it would still, you know, it's a confusing thing. I mean, Radiohead puts out In Rainbows, and it's free. You can just go get it, pay whatever you want or whatever. Universally loved, right? So a purely logical person who's not sort of involved with the nuance of how human nature and culture works, if you're just straight logic, like just from, you know, you're like, well, okay, people love when a record is free. Wouldn't they love it more if that free record didn't even involve them pressing a button, if it was just there? You know, it seems like it makes sense, but the opposite is true. And not only did it not make people happy, it probably made people who might have enjoyed that record like it less. Like,
right.
Like they might have appreciated that record more. They might have said, well, you know, this is their best record in 12 years or whatever. it had just been on Spotify.
Right. You know, talking about this U2 record, it's making me think about the Adele record. And when we're recording this, this is like a week after the Adele record came out. And I think it was just announced that broke NSYNC's sales record.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm starting to think, I wonder if how far away we are from someone in the record industry deciding we're not going to market to kids anymore. We're only going to market to parents with, you know, youngest children between the ages of like 35 and 55. Because they're the only people who seem to buy music with any regularity. Because obviously, pop music is always going to run on youth.
That's already happened to some degree. Whenever you see a band be like, "We're only putting our record in Walmart," that's what they're doing.
Right.
You know, that they're saying that like we're exclusively trying to sell this to people who are older than 35. I mean, the Adele thing. I mean, she's going to sell these records, you know. But it's sort of a manifestation of if you democratize everything. If suddenly most music, for the most part, is the equivalent of free, well, the only people who are in a position to really sort of say, I'm not playing that game, I'm not putting my record on Spotify, you got to buy it, is like Adele and Taylor Swift and stuff like that. It actually gives the elite artist more power, because now they're the only people who can make money off of recorded music. I mean, if you're let's say there was a Strokes-like band emerging now, like a cool-looking band from New York who had at least one record of worth of good songs, they couldn't say like, "Hey, you know what? We're not putting this on any streaming services," because nobody would hear about them. They need to tour. They have to do that. Like you can only not stream your music for free if you are already super rich.
Right. I do wonder though if at some point people are going to wise up and only, if you're a rock band, for instance, because one area of growth that no one ever talks about is like the jam band scene. It's sort of like the redheaded stepchild of music and certainly of music coverage. And yet these bands will come to your town and it'll be some band you never heard of. Like there's this one band called Lettuce, who I've never heard of. They're like a funk band, I think, from Texas. But like they'll sell out Red Rocks, you know, because they have a grassroots following. People collect their recordings. You know, they go on archive and they listen to their music that way. You know, this band probably doesn't sell any records, but they make a ton of money on the road. And it seems like that's a model that I would think would become more common as we move ahead. Just because, you know, as people realize that they're not going to make any money off of records.
Well, sure. I mean, if somebody wants to make a living in music, and that's their only goal, they don't have a goal to be a specific kind of artist or to express themselves in any kind of particular way. If they're like, "I want to make a living as a musician," being in a jam band like that probably would be the most reasonable option, but that's a rare way for someone to get into a career in music, you know, to be like that kind of overtly careerist. What is interesting is you say like it's like not written about. That's true, you know, and when you go back to the early phases of jam music, like the Grateful Dead and stuff like that, that was seen as pretty political music, okay? That was more political than the other music that was happening around it. But now jam band music is a purely musical sort of endeavor, like post-Phish. It is basically guys who, with a lot of virtuosity, you can play complicated things, but don't really have any sort of political or identity politics or anything involved. And that makes and people don't really write about music that doesn't include that now. Like that's sort of the reason. That's sort of the thing you write about when you write about popular music. So jam bands have now become almost like a, you know, like something that is of interest to the kind of person who in the 70s was interested in King Crimson or like just purely musico type stuff.
Right. Right. You know, you were talking before about how as a writer, you think of yourself as a generalist. But there was a time obviously when you were working for Spin, you were writing about music on a regular basis. And then you moved on from Spin and started doing a lot more other things. Do you feel like your interest in music has shifted, or was that more of like a professional interest that you got sick of writing about music?
Well, a little bit of both. I mean, definitely my interest in music has shifted dramatically, almost exclusively for technological reasons, in the sense now that I find that one, the time of my life, you know, like because I have a kid and because of all these things going on, I have less time to listen to music. That's part of it. So if I'm not going to explore music the way I used to, I'm going to listen to things that I have a desire to hear. But also it just sort of feels like music finds me now in a way that it didn't for a period. Like it's I don't need to do anything in order to experience it. So I'm probably, the way I listen to music now is probably closer to the way, this is weird, that I listened to music like in fifth grade, where where it was just sort of like I liked it. So I would just sort of maybe listen to one song I like 25 times. Or I would hear about some artist and I would just listen to them for a day, just be into that for a day. It doesn't seem as though, I mean, when I was at Spin, it was literally my job to sort of be into everything and to kind of know about all of this stuff, regardless of how it resonated with me personally. And now I don't listen to any music that I don't like. Like if I'm listening to something and I don't like it, I stop listening to it. There's a weird thing about that, which is that for the most part, the artists that you like the most very often initially don't resonate with you. Like it takes a while. And in fact, it's sort of like when people talk about lyrics, you know, it's like if you can understand what the lyrics are to a song the first time you listen to it, that usually means they're not very good. Like you're supposed to, you need to listen to things lots and lots and lots of times in order to, if it's sophisticated and if it's complicated, like you shouldn't be able to really understand what it thematically is suggesting with one listen. But we've really moved away from that culturally. So now the things that we reward are the things that are immediate. I mean, immediate's a positive way to look at it. I guess it's negative, you'd say superficial. But that's sort of the music that works now. Things that sound good through the speakers of a computer the first time you hear it. And that's kind of a different model for how this works.
I mean, I guess this is a two-part question, but like, do you still keep up with new music? And as a, you know, pop culture writer, do you feel like it's necessary to keep up with new music? Or is it maybe not that important in the larger culture to know what pop music is doing right now?
You know, I don't know, because I don't know how much the average person keeps up with music. I don't know how much the quote unquote serious music fan keeps up with new music. I don't know what the baseline is. You know, when I was a working rock critic, and not just at Spin, but like at newspapers, you know, the records would get sent to me like the week before, 2 weeks before they came out, I'd get the new record. So I'd be like, okay, so this is sort of what the main labels or the indie labels are pushing right now. So I'll listen to these, and that's kind of the new music. It doesn't work that way now. It's a totally different system that I'm kind of alienated from the system. So my answer, I guess, to me, it feels like I don't keep up with new music. But I'm like a 43-year-old guy. I mean, how much is a 43-year-old guy supposed to be engaged with music that's being consciously created for 16-year-old people? Like if when I hear like a new pop song and I like it immediately, I have two thoughts. I'm like either A, this is transcendent music that appeals to all demographics in a way that will make it a potentially timeless song, or B, it's not very good because I like it. And like it's not really, you know, it's not working if it's appealing to me. I'm not supposed to be the person it appeals to. So either it's just transcendent and appeals to everyone like a Beatles song, or it's almost like a reduced version of pop music that appeals to anybody who hears it once, but nobody who listens to it 100 times.
What about like new rock bands? Because, you know, certainly pop music is still geared toward, you know, teenagers and people in their 20s. But you know, rock music now, you know, the demographic basically starts at 30 and goes up until, I guess, you're deaf or something, if you're old and you can't even hear music anymore. But, you know, with the exception of like a Tame Impala or something.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, they seem to be kind of the highest profile working band right now. And their profile seems low to me.
Well, as far as like young people go, I mean, because I would say like a band like The National, for instance, they sell about 250,000 records each time they go out. They can play large theaters and in arenas. But if you look at their crowd, it's going to generally be guys in their 30s. In their girlfriends and older, or a band like the War on Drugs, for instance, yeah. Probably more, you know, they can sell out Radio City Music Hall, but they're not really like a youth oriented band. I mean, is that something you keep up with? Like, are you interested in new rock bands, or is the fact that they're not youth music or not on the cusp of like the cutting edge of culture, does that like lessen it for you? Less than your
well, interest. The second part is no factor at all. Right. Whether or not it's on that, I mean, that's completely irrelevant. But you know, okay, rock is clearly receding from the culture, and there have been many times in the past when that seemed to be the case. I mean, when the Beatles broke up, people were like, "Oh my God, this whole idea of rock music done." Of course it was. And then disco became popular and new wave, and there was electronic music, and there was all these little short windows of time where it seemed like rock was receding and was going to be sort of replaced by either a new version of rock or something else entirely. So when this started to happen this last time, and which I think actually is the time when it really is going to happen, I was skeptical like anyone else. I was like, well, this is just sort of a phase. But it has. It's kind of like, it's just the world has changed in this way. And rock music was the most, you know, the dominant musical culture for, you know, roughly 50 years or whatever, you know, and now it's sort of receding. So when I see new rock bands, it feels to me like people who were almost like they're sort of the way maybe jazz artists seemed in the 80s or something, where they're doing something that almost seems to be like an homage or a tribute to these things that have come before. And this is just a problem. I bet you experienced this. Anybody who writes about culture has this experience, you know? It's like, when you're young, you see something, and it's an old idea, but you're seeing it for the first time. So it seems completely new. And the experience you have with it and the reaction you have with it is identical to the original version. Like, you're not shaped at all by history. This new version of an old thing is exciting and dynamic, you know? And then, again in your life, you see it happen again, okay? And the second time you see it, you're like, oh, it's interesting. It reminds me of the first time I saw this. I like this too, because it connects you to that original experience you had. And then you see it happen again. And then you're like, well, that's kind of weird now. I feel like I've had this experience three times. And then it happens a fourth time. And eventually it does start to be this case where you almost have to either willfully decide that you're going to try to get yourself back in the mindset of who you were when you were young, and that you're just going to have a visceral experience with this, even if it contradicts your intellectual memory, or what you like about these things is going to change entirely. And that's sort of what has happened to me. So now when I see a new rock band, I don't even have a good example of this, but whenever I do, the things I like or dislike about them don't really feel the same as the reasons I would have liked or disliked something in 1996. Does that make sense at all?
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, like a band like Japandroids, for instance, which is kind of consciously drawing on the rock continuum, and you can hear the Replacements, you can hear Appetite for Destruction a little bit in there. So like a band like that, you're saying, when you hear them now, you can enjoy it maybe, but you also feel like you're sort of processing them through the lens of other experiences that you've had in the past.
Yeah, and it's I mean, that's part of it. It's just, I don't know. I don't want to be someone who views the world the same way forever. And, you know, and I think that it's kind of a contradictory thing, right? Because I like classic rock. So when a classic rock band reforms, for example, and, you know, they do a reunion show, there's kind of a certain kind of thinking that says, well, if the show is good, it'll make you feel young. And if the show is bad, it will remind you that you're old. Well, right. and that's actually, whoever said that first, it's actually a very insightful thing, because that there is some truth in that, that if you see a band you loved and that you used to love when you were young and it's just great, you'll be like transported back to that time. But if they're not so good, they look old, and then you're like, well, I'm old too, all these things. The idea of being transported back to my youth doesn't seem desirable to me. Even when I say it, it sounds like something that should be desirable, like some kind of, you know, Ponce de Leon scenario with a band. But I don't want that, I guess. I mean, I like being older. I like the way my mind has changed.
Right.
But the downside to that is that some things are harder to appreciate. Right. You know?
I mean, the thing, you know, the rock is receding point. I think that for a certain kind of band, that's inarguable. Like, you know, you're not going to see the new Axl Rose walk through the door ever again. I think, or the next Kurt Cobain. I think that kind of rock band, as far as being like a pop music act, is over. However, it is interesting how words change over time and how meanings change over the time, because, you know, there was a period, obviously, of several decades, like where rock and roll had sort of a fixed definition, and really it was used as like an all-purpose term to describe yes. all kinds of pop music. But there's artists today that aren't described as rock that I think would have been called rock maybe 20 or 30 years ago. Like if you listen to Eric Church, for instance, mm-hmm. he's essentially making John Cougar Mellencamp records. Like the Heartland rock genre, which doesn't exist anymore, was absorbed into country.
He sings about rock bands.
Right.
Like he sings about having the experience of liking rock, but he's singing it as like a country artist, essentially.
But even like a Taylor Swift, you know, she plays guitar, she's a singer-songwriter, and she plays arenas. Like, I feel like if she was in the 70s, she would be likened to rock music. But because rock music doesn't have that same sort of meaning anymore, it doesn't fit. Like, when people say the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, they get confused because they feel like, well, is this a rock museum or is this a music museum? And it's because the significance of rock and roll as a term has changed from what it was in the mid-80s when that thing was founded to now. You know, like One Direction is essentially a rock band, and if you listen to their records, they're referencing rock records from the past a lot of the time, but they don't seem like a rock band, they seem like a pop band.
Yeah, well, I mean, words do change. I mean, the term rock star, for example, the term rock star is a positive word when applied to anything except a musician. Like, if you're a rock star public defender, people are like, you're the coolest, highest profile, most successful public defender. Like, if you say, like, you have a rock star tax attorney, it means, like, he's got long hair and he has a hot tub and he's a cool tax attorney and everyone, you know. But if you call a musician a rock star, you're saying, well, he's kind of bloated. You know, he lost touch with his fan base. You know, it's like, it's the only place that it's a negative term. In every other way, to say someone's a rock star is a compliment. Not if you're complimenting the front man of a rock band. That is an insult.
Right, totally. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about Spin when you worked there. It was interesting. I reread the opening of Killing Yourself to Live before we got on the phone today. Because you write a little bit about what the Spin mm-hmm. offices were like in the early 2000s. And there's a line in there where you say something like, it was always the spring of 1996 at Spin. And like when I read that, I don't know if you intended this, but I mean, the implication in my mind is that it was almost like Spin was already past its prime at that point, or the moment had passed where a magazine like that was still relevant. And of course, now looking back, it seems like your era, like that early 2000s era, was like the last sort of time when it was relevant. But like, I mean, was that the feeling at the time that, oh, maybe, you know, we're here like 3 or 4 years too late?
Well, okay, did we feel that way? I don't know if we directly felt that way while we were there. It was such a great, fun place to work. I mean, it was, I just got to say, it was the best 4 years of my life, you know? But were we there too late in terms of, like, being a cutting-edge rock magazine? Sure. But it was like, we didn't care about that. like the history of Spin is just fascinating to me. Okay, like, so Spin starts kind of as an alternative to Rolling Stone, and they're like the smaller, cooler version of what Rolling Stone is. But by chance, because the bands they were covering ended up becoming bands like Nirvana and Pearl Jam and the Pixies and all these things, their audience just exploded. So Spin goes from this magazine with a circulation, I'm making these figures up, but like the circulation is like 150,000, and all of a sudden it's 400,000 in the early 90s. And they can put Dinosaur Jr. on the cover. You know, people in North Dakota are like, I'm going to buy this. I'm going to read about Jay Mascis, you know. And this kind of amazing thing happens where, because they, by chance, were covering the music that was going to become huge, they sort of became huge. But then all those, that scene kind of collapsed. And the idea that any band, you know, that sounded like Soundgarden or whatever would be huge, that was over. So then Spin had to move into this phase kind of like called New Spin in the 90s, where they were like, well, now we're going to cover bands that we don't even necessarily think are cool, but they have some kind of connection to alt-rock. And then they went to new Spin. That was like when we'll put Futurama on the cover, or like, you know, we'll put movies on the cover. We'll be a music magazine that doesn't really cover music that much. Then I got hired for like what was called, I suppose, like new old Spin. The idea that the new Spin was going to be sort of like the old Spin, and we were going to cover like what we thought was kind of the cool thing about rock, but there was just there wasn't anything to cover. So then we moved to old new Spin, which was sort of like the old version of when Spin was going to be new, and we would put, you know. And then Andy Pemberton came in when my boss, Michael, got fired, and I got fired, and Vitzkoff and all these people got pushed out. Then they went to really old Spin again, which seemed to work for a while. But, I mean, in terms of were we late, I mean, it was like the recession of rock had already happened, and no one really realized it. So when the Strokes were new, we were like, this is going to be our band. Like, we're going to kind of get behind it. And almost at one point, it almost felt like we were working for the Strokes. It just, that's what it kind of seemed like.
Well, like Interpol, we were, right? Wasn't Interpol a big band, like, for Spin at that time?
So they were right in there. I mean, you know, there was a few bands in there that we were really kind of behind for what we felt that they personified or what they signified, you know. And it turns out, like, you know, sometimes they just weren't that popular, or they just weren't that good, or whatever the case may be. But what I was so great about it is, like, okay, I say it was, you know, I said it was always like the spring of 96 or whatever. In the very first episode of Portlandia, I feel like the two characters are walking on the street. Maybe it was just a promo for Portlandia. And the Fred Armiston character is like, remember the 90s when he was sort of like, he just like the emphasis was just not on making it. Like the idea, like the emphasis was just kind of on hanging out and like not making fun of things that were cool and all that. Like that was very much the vibe of being at Spin. It was just like a, you know, there was lots of really smart people there. You know, all these cool, attractive women working there who were like, would laugh at a joke about Hawkwind, you know, and you could just sort of, you know, everybody partied. It was just a great time. And it felt like we were sort of, you know, making this magazine. Making this magazine for ourselves, but that wasn't even the case. Like, we were making the magazine for a version of ourselves from the 90s. And it was like, isn't it crazy they let us do this?
Right.
It was a real good time. And it was just really, like, I learned so much during that period, but not even, like, about music or journalism, just because I was surrounded by these people who just could talk about anything. And it was just a great time, you know? So I look back at that very nostalgically, and I think that all the people who worked there during the early 2000s, many of the people at least, probably look back at it nostalgically, but not really as a magazine, more like as an experience.
We're running out of time here, so I just have a couple more questions I want to ask. First of all, I know you have a book coming out later this year. I'm saying later this year because this, I'm assuming this podcast is going to run in 2016. Can you talk about that at all?
Well, it's a nonfiction book, and it's sort of about the idea of how will the culture of the present tense appear in the distant future, like 100 or 300 or 1,000 years. Sort of like if you, like, I looked back and I interviewed people and I sort of looked back on things both subjectively and objectively from the past. And I was like, well, what is the criteria we use to sort of remember what gets canonized or what becomes important or what we sort of accept to be true? And I tried to apply that to the world of today, because for the most part, the things that we like in the present tense, that the reasoning we use is very different than the reasoning we use for what we like about things historically.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to write about the present tense as if it was history.
Oh, can you give me an example, or do you want to keep that under wraps for now?
Let's not talk too much about it yet. It'll come out in June. I mean, usually when I write a book, I feel real insecure about it and immediately seems bad. But yeah, I feel good about this. I feel like this one worked. And like, if this book fails, I'll almost be like, well, now what do I do? I mean, like, this seems like this is the best I can do.
So yeah.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, I hate describing ideas out loud. I feel like I describe my ideas very poorly. You actually did a good job of describing that. That sounds intriguing. So,
well, the tough thing is, if you can really describe a book anecdotally in 20 seconds, that means you have a great pitch and probably a problematic book. I mean, like if I could say exactly what the idea and the content of this book is, well, then I really wouldn't need to write it, right?
Right.
It's like almost, it almost has to be inherently impossible to describe in a conversation. Otherwise, there would be no need to explain it over 250 pages.
Right. Well, this last question, it ties into your book idea, or your book inadvertently in a way. As you know, in 2015, you did you interviewed four very famous people: Kobe Bryant, Eddie Van Halen, Taylor Swift, and Tom Brady. And this is a three-part question. Number one, I was wondering who you were personally most excited to interview. Who do you think is the most significant right now, and who will be the most significant in like 50 years?
Okay. The first one was, who was I most excited about interviewing?
Yeah.
Eddie Van Halen.
Okay, I imagine that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The second question was,
like, who's the most significant of those four right now?
Well, as a personality, the most significant person is Taylor Swift, no question. But in terms of as it applies to the stories I did, I suppose the Kobe Bryant story is the most significant, because he was absolutely the most forthcoming, by far the most interesting. I can't say he was the most self-aware, but he was the most willing to inject his self-awareness into his responses. So of the four stories, I would say that one was the best one of them from my perspective.
And like in 50 years, out of those four people, who do you think people will care about the most?
Hmm.
Like still care about?
Yeah, in 50 years. Well, okay, this is interesting. Let's go back 50 years from now. So that would be 1965, is that right?
Yeah.
1966, okay. Okay, if we go back to 1965, do we remember athletes from that time more or musicians? Well, I guess maybe this is like a weird date to pick, because certainly from 1965 it would be musicians. But I think that would actually be true also in 1975 and 1985. So my gut would tell me that it would probably be Taylor Swift, probably. Although, I mean, if Tom Brady ends his career as the greatest quarterback of all time, and no one really usurps that, I suppose people could be interested in him in the way that people were interested in Joe DiMaggio or whatever, you know. And although if that's the case, like, my story isn't especially revelatory, because he didn't say a goddamn thing. He didn't say anything, you know.
Right.
And like, I went into that. I did that interview because I was told that you could talk about anything. And I was like, well, this is, you know, this is going to be sort of the defining story of his view and his relationship with the deflated allegations. That would be super interesting to me. But of course, that was not true at all. That was just a way they just said that, and they never intended to do it. So the story itself really is a Q&A in the middle of an essay I wrote. And I mean, I'm very much of the opinion that if you write a piece and the main thing people remember about that piece is the writing, it failed. Like, what people should remember is what the person said. Did the person answer a question they had not answered before? And
so you're looking at it.
Part.
So you think as a journalist before a writer. Before you think as a writer in that instance.
Yeah, I mean, this is just something that has just evolved with me over time. I mean, when I was a young person, I was much more interested in the actual prose, in the actual writing. And if I said, I loved this profile, or, you know, I loved this essay, it was because I loved the writing. Now, if I say I love this profile, it's because the reporter got something from the person that I had not seen before that recontextualizes their work. And if I say I like this essay, it's because the person had an idea that hadn't occurred to me before.
Right.
Those are the only things now to me that make me say something is good.
Right.
So, I mean, like, when I if I read something and I'm really impressed by the sentence structure and the sentence construction and all those things, what I think to myself is, like, that person is talented. They're talented at writing. But, like, that it's also what you do when you don't get anything from the person. And I've certainly had that experience in my life where I have written features that I think on the surface seem pretty good because of things that I wrote, and yet that's kind of fake. That's what you do when you don't have anything real. Yeah.
To go back to those four people, like, the one person you didn't really talk about was Eddie Van Halen. And the argument I'll make in favor of Van Halen is that it's possible that he could be Charlie Parker, the Charlie Parker of the guitar, and that I think he's the only one out of those four that people might end up remembering as the best person to do what he did ever.
Oh, okay.
Because I think in sports, it's inevitable that someone's going to be a better quarterback than Tom Brady in the next 50 years. Kobe Bryant isn't the best basketball player of all time now. There will be people who are better than him, you know, just because of how technology changes and people are going to be better taken care of. So I think, in a way, moving forward, I wonder if athletes will be remembered less just because their achievements won't seem as impressive. You know, because, like, I think with DiMaggio and like a Joe Namath or something, there's their numbers, but there's also, like, what they stood for in the culture. You know, there was
there was
a romance to those people. So
But you also said 50 years.
Yeah.
If you say 100 years, then I would say the likelihood that Eddie Van Halen moves up increases because of the four. He is the most formally inventive. And the longer, the more time passes, the greater passage of time, the more emphasis on formal invention, the more that gets amplified.
Right.
So, you know, now the problem that Eddie Van Halen has, and this is a weird way to say this is a problem, but in the context of this conversation, total memory of the future, he will never be the defining electrical guitarist.
Right.
The defining electric guitarist will be Jimi Hendrix. So he can't, but it's the same thing, I guess, you know, Kobe Bryant can't be the defining basketball player of his generation. You know, Tom Brady, I guess, could be. Taylor Swift could be. And I do think that Taylor Swift does really represent, like, the most positive and, I guess, potentially negative cliches about what people call millennials. So if in 100 years from now, for whatever reason, people are interested in thinking about or writing about the idea of what a millennial was, she will certainly be a character in this futuristic documentary or whatever. I guess my suspicion is that because I really do feel that rock is receding, that what will end up happening is that rock music will end up being defined by one individual or one artist or one group, in the same way that so many other genres of music, when they kind of recede, end up being defined by the, like, the one great person or the one great man theory or whatever. And I don't think that will be Eddie Van Halen. But
so, like, Bob Marley with reggae or something? Like,
Bob Marley with reggae is a very good example. I mean, in the sense that in 50 years or 100 years, it is very easy to imagine a world where Bob Marley as a personality is as famous or more famous than the music of reggae, in the same way that, you know, John Philip Sousa is almost as famous as marching music. Like the, there just tends to be this the way culture works is that, and this is kind of partially things I write about in this book, I guess, is that as things disappear and become almost an academic pursuit, a lot of the pillars and, like, the pieces get whittled away. And, you know, people drop off. Bands, you know, like, let's say rock recedes and we move forward. The Doors get forgotten, and the Who get forgotten. And eventually it's just, you know, maybe the Rolling Stones, the Beatles and all these things. But what happens is they get all whittled away until there's one left. And then that person gets exaggerated. It's like they remove all the pieces until there's one piece left. And then that piece becomes the genre in totality. And I suspect that's what will happen with rock music over time. And it will be interesting if in 500 years in some classroom, if people talk about rock music the way we talk about the music from Mesopotamia now or whatever, how it will be described and who will be, like, the one personality that will sort of come to define an entire universe of culture.
So who would that be? Like, if you had to guess, would you, like Dylan? Is it the Beatles?
Well, this is a chapter of the book.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Alrighty. Yeah. I would say Bob Dylan would probably be the person, just because of what he did, and also he fits that great man archetype, you know, for better or worse, probably as well as any other person.
You are not the only person who thought that, you know. I end up concluding it's probably going to be a different person, and okay. I have reasons as to why. But here again, you know, this is I'm always tentative to give too much away because you say something, you know, because like here again, like this book, like rock music is only a sliver of this. But anybody who listens to this podcast and they'll be like, oh, he's got a book coming out, and it's about, like, will Dylan survive? You know, people get things wrong.
Yeah. Well, I feel proud that I weaseled out this little morsel out of you. I wasn't expecting that, so
worked out well. You win,
so. Well, Chuck, thanks for being on the podcast, man, and good luck with everything.
Well, I'm flattered you asked.
Yeah. All right, so there you have it. That was Chuck Klosterman. Really fun talking with him. I'm sure we'll have him back on the podcast at some point. So that's it for this episode of the Celebration Rock Podcast. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next week.